From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And this morning, we speak first with Dr. Boris Heifetz. He's a neuroanesthesiologist at Stanford Medical School. He discusses the use of psychedelics and the placebo effect. It's all in a recent article in Scientific American titled, "Is a drug even needed to induce a psychedelic experience?"
Sounds interesting. Then local author Dick Gary with his new book, Just Another Dick, The Presumptuous Memoir of a Truly Unimportant Person. It's the riotous story of a man who rose to respectability in an unconventional way.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Our next guest, Dr. Boris Heifetz, is a board-certified anesthesiologist at Stanford Medical School and specializes in providing anesthesia for neurological surgery. Now, Dr. Heifetz completed fellowship training in neuroanesthesiology, also at Stanford, and in addition to treating patients, Dr. Heifetz's research group studies how new rapid-acting psychiatric therapies like ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin produce lasting changes in nervous system function, behavior, and therapeutic outcomes. He's also featured in a recent article in Scientific American magazine in which he explores the question, is a drug even needed to induce a psychedelic experience? Which is the title of the article from July 3rd of this year. Dr. Heifetz joins us this morning to tell us more. Dr. Heifetz, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having me. Look forward to having an exciting discussion about psychedelics.
Yes. Well, first of all, let's just get started with this. As an anesthesiologist, when did using psychedelics for treatment of various things like PTSD, addiction, and depression come onto your radar?
So I'm a little bit unusual in this field. So as you're probably aware, psychedelics have been in the news quite a bit ever since Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. Most of my colleagues in this field are psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, people in the mental health field. And I've come at it from a bit of a different direction. And that, as an anesthesiologist, we put people to sleep, we wake them up, we, watch over them during surgery. It's a big deal in people's lives. And it struck me at some point, and I've had a background in neuroscience and have been interested in psychedelics for many years already, but that this is another big event that people go through, and we don't usually attend to mental health issues in that period. So for example, surgery, we know that mental health conditions in general tend to get worse during stress, right? And it's pretty rare that you know the date and time of your next major life stressor, like having your hip replaced, for example. And what the data show is that a lot of the time people after surgery, their mood gets worse, they can develop opioid dependence problems that they didn't have before, and that's a complex relationship between pain and mood. So this is something that's really how this got on my radar, is that I've been studying, interested in psychedelics and seeing these issues in clinical practice. And I saw a lot of parallels between what we're doing in the operating room and what's going on out in psychedelic therapy land.
I have so many questions, but I guess it starts with being someone who administers anesthesia for neurological surgery. So you are seeing how drugs affect a person neurologically, and that's been a big part of your study. Before we get into talking about the study that you did with people who are undergoing surgery, which is so fascinating, people who I know who have gone through treatment for mostly depression via the use of the administered and guided use of psilocybin come away and it has been very effective, but at the end of the day, they don't really know if it has changed them neurologically. And I just want to get your opinion on that first, then we'll get into the study.
the bottom line is we don't understand how psychedelics work, and there are a lot of ideas out there, and you kind of have to, the way that people approach this question, and I started this by saying I approach it a little bit differently because of my medical background, but people approach it differently. You have people from the psychopharmacology world, meaning people who are schooled in the idea of you have drugs and they bind to specific receptors in your brain, and those receptors trigger these biochemical changes. That's, you know, it's a reductionist model, as they say, of how the brain works. And that can lead you down a path of thinking about how these work, which is that you're inducing some sort of change in the way your neurons look, in the way they work, and that if we understand those changes, that might be enough to explain how psychedelics cause these long-lasting apparent improvements. There are another approach is, you know, really more from the social sciences and even from religious studies, which is looking at mystical experiences. And that's, if you look at the Renaissance in psychedelic research, which was really kicked off at Johns Hopkins almost 20 years ago now, with a really incredible paper from the late Roland Griffiths. The title was, paraphrasing, "Psilocybin Occasions Mystical Experiences." And this is wild to me. I read it, you know, when it came out. It was in the Journal of Psychopharmacology. And what was remarkable is that there was not a single word about pharmacology in the title of this paper. It's a paper about mystical experiences in a psychopharmacology journal. So that was a change in thinking, and maybe a callback to a much older way of thinking about mental health and psychiatry in general, which is really through understanding experience. So these are the kind of the poles that we're talking about are, you know, the role of drugs and biochemistry and the role of experience. And these two paths have really diverged in modern mental health and the way we, you know, scale treatment. So if you think about, and this is changing, but, you know, if you go with a complaint, you know, I don't take pleasure in life anymore, things just, the colors aren't as bright, I don't want to see friends, you might get prescribed an antidepressant, and or you might get prescribed psychotherapy. And one of the big complaints that has emerged, you know, in social media, wherever you look really, is that the drugs don't work, that it's not enough. But that's sort of been our model. And they do work for some people. I want to be very clear on that. You know, drugs that are derived from Prozac, you know, SSRI type drugs have helped a lot of people. But the and the way we think about that help in many cases is that it's a biochemical change. It sort of happens without you knowing it. And I'll be honest, I've experienced this myself. I was on SSRIs for a period, and I noticed, I was surprised because it crept on slowly, and I suddenly noticed my pattern of thinking changing. And that was very helpful to me. I know a lot of other people have found that too, but it didn't feel like it wasn't the same thing as what we're talking about here, which is psychedelics, where you have this big, you know, blowout once in a lifetime, you know, very meaningful, personally meaningful experience. And that perspective shift changes your life. That's a very different way of thinking about things than neurons blooming, new dendrites and connections because of the drug you took. So this has been one of the central tensions, I think, in where psychedelic therapy is going. And depending on which, you know, where you fall in that camp, people, you know, it's probably both. You know, I think it's usually safe to say there's that one or the other, but it leads you down a very different path in terms of how we scale these treatments up, how we get them to millions of people who might benefit from them. And if you think of it as like the Prozac-like model, and you try, and there are a lot of industrial efforts now to re-engineer psychedelic drugs to be less psychoactive, to have less of a trip, to, you know, keep those chemical aspects of it that will make your neurons bloom and bloom new connections, and maybe you're not aware of it, but to kind of diminish the experience aspect of it. So that's one direction we could go. The other direction, which is one I'm far more interested in, to be honest, is how do you actually characterize that experience? Like, what, you know, that's one aspect of what's happening when you take a psychedelic, is the biochemical changes. All the other stuff, which is what you're there for, is the experience, the ineffable, the sense of awe, the sense of connection, and what people often describe as a fundamental change of perspective that happens. That, how do you even describe that? How do you scale that up? How do you put a box around that and, you know, deliver it to a doorstep of, you know, the 25 million people who are diagnosed with depression in the US right now?
So in the article, you talk about specifically three types. Can you give us a little clearer? I think there's like the bio effect, the conscious effect, and the drug factors. Can you break that down just a bit for us?
So this outline now is this tension in the field is, how do you move forward with developing, scaling, and, you know, making this a bona fide mental health treatment that most Americans can access? And we need to understand how it works. That to me is the inescapable question, is that psilocybin itself, for example, might not be for everybody, but some version of it might be. And if we want to figure it out, we need to know how it works. And the way that I think about it, given all the complexity about, there are basically three possibilities, they're mutually exclusive, is the drug effect. Well, we'll call the drug effect, which is really that, I'll call it almost an SSRI-like effect, where it doesn't require conscious awareness. It's something that happens at the level of biochemistry and the structure of your neurons. And, you know, it may be linked to an experience, but it's really maybe an independent factor. The other piece, so that's the drug. The other piece is the trip. Now, the trip, I think everyone knows what the trip is. I'm happy to go into what that might be like, but the trip is a powerful psychoactive and, you know, personally meaningful experience. We clearly think of that as related to the drug you just took, right? It's like usually those go together, but they might not actually be necessarily linked. You might be able to break that linkage and look at them as independent factors, right? What if you had a similar experience without a drug involved? And that's something that is an empirical, testable question, it turns out. And then, so we have the drug, we have the trip, and then what we'll call the non-drug factors. So these are things that we typically put on blinders when we evaluate a treatment. We give a drug in a clinical trial, maybe we give some therapy, and then we just assume that the two groups we're comparing, that everything else is the same. But what we're often ignoring is that there are all these non-drug factors like hope, expectations. How do you make sense in the aftermath of a powerful experience? Like, these are things that aren't related to the specific drug, and they're just general change mechanisms that, you know, psychotherapists, for example, will take advantage of, that, you know, that you, if you can look forward to something that can be life-changing as well. Just the idea of a big experience, you know, and what happens in the aftermath. So to sum it up, it's the drug effect, the biochemical effect, the experience, and the non-drug factors are the way that I think about it.
So that leads into really what your study has kind of been around. And I found it fascinating. I mean, the time that you spent, I won't go too far into it. We'd like to hear from you, but just the time you spent in talking to your patients and as they were getting ready to go into surgery. So that kind of tees it up for you a little bit. There was a placebo group, obviously. Tell us a little bit about the outcome of that, the drug versus the experience and expectation of things getting better.
So just a little bit of background, and, you know, this is not done in a vacuum. My colleagues in psychiatry, Alan Schatzberg and Laura Hack and Teresa Lee, who's a fantastic pain physician who helped lead the study. This is what we were testing. We were trying to get at this question of, is it the drug or the trip? And we thought, awesome, we're anesthesiologists, we can answer this. We're going to give a powerful psychoactive antidepressant called ketamine, right? It's in broad use, but we're going to do it during general anesthesia. We see patients all the time who come in with moderate to severe depression. They're here for a hernia repair or, you know, a lumpectomy. And why not test? Like, while they're unconscious, we can give them the, you know, a psychedelic class drug and see if they recover from depression. And the idea was, well, they'll have the drug, they'll have the biochemical effect, but they won't have the experience. So that is a way that we could really tease apart that linkage. And what we found went completely against our expectations. And actually, we didn't end up answering that question at all. Well, we did a little bit. So we had two groups. We had and everyone had moderate to severe depression. And one group, everyone had general anesthesia with standard anesthetic cocktails, and one group got ketamine in a standard dose, and one group got placebo. And we, when they woke up from surgery in the next few days, we asked them about their mood, standard sort of methods. And the ketamine group got better. Awesome. 50%, you know, cut their symptoms in half. 30% were in remission from major depressive disorder. I was so excited. And the placebo group, 50% cut their symptoms in half and 30% went into remission. So I was a little bit less excited because that doesn't make any sense to me. I thought, you know, ketamine did its thing. Like it did the same thing that it does in every other study, which is patients get better, like we saw. What we were not expecting was this massive placebo response. So yeah, maybe we took the trip out of the drug experience, but we're still getting this massive, people are getting better. And that, you know, and just anecdotally talking to these patients, I remember so clearly, there are a couple that really stand out, but one patient, she was there for cancer, you know, like fifth cancer surgery, like really, you know, pretty intense stuff. And she was like almost dancing in her room on day one after this big abdominal surgery. I mean, it was infectious. It was the kind of, you know, transformation. Like I haven't felt like this in years. Like, you know, I could, you know, it was like, it made me light up. And that's when you know that there's something going on. And I thought, my goodness, if this woman didn't get ketamine, she had to have gotten the treatment. Like, how do you explain this sort of change? And, you know, of course she was in the placebo group.
Wait a minute, before you go on, Boris, I just have to ask you about the knowledge or lack of knowledge that the patients had ahead of time about if they were going to be administered a drug, what it was. Did they know it was ketamine?
So Lynn, that really gets to the heart of the question, is why. That's what I think we came to this conclusion after, you know, really thinking about it for quite a while, is, you know, what is it that we're not taking into account here? And it's those non-drug factors that I started with. And when we finished the trial and we look back, like, what was the common element? Like, typically patients don't get better after surgery in terms of mood, right? We know that from hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. Why are our patients getting better? And it's, Lynn, it's what you said. It's that when we look back at how are we treating these patients differently? Well, we were very excited to do this trial. So we messaged people about their mental health weeks. If you've ever had surgery, you might find it surprising to get an email saying, like, we care about your mental health during your recovery. Nobody cares about that. Like, surgeons are busy, you know, they want to do their thing. They want to fix the problem, you know, and this other stuff is usually not the focus. So patients were, some of them were surprised pleasantly, and we reached out to them. Sometimes we reached out multiple times. Once we found them, we talked to them. We listened to them. People, in some cases, it really, you know, and patients have given me this feedback that they felt seen and heard in a way that they haven't for a very long time. These are patients who've had years of major depressive disorder, a lot of trauma, the background, a lot of issues that have just been unaddressed. And so there were, in these intake interviews, often for a couple hours, really, like, you know, two-on-one, our whole team is listening attentively, like trying to get this history out. So we're interacting with patients in a way that we don't usually do before surgery, in a way that really gets at what's going on in their lives. And then the last piece of this is that we're putting a very specific expectation in their minds, which, you know, is part of the clinical trial process. When we get informed consent for a study, you have to tell them what you're doing, right? And the way that they describe the study, of course, is that, well, we think that ketamine may help, but we don't know. Clearly, you know, we express some ambivalence because this is why we're doing the study. Okay. We think ketamine helps people who are in other, you know, life, you know, in awake populations. We want to test if it's going to help with your mood while you're unconscious. So there's a 50-50 chance that you'll get ketamine while you're under general anesthesia. And we want to ask you, we're going to follow up with you closely after surgery to ask you about your mood. So if put yourself in the position of a patient, right? I'm having hip surgery. I don't want to have hip surgery. I'm scared. I'm nervous. I've had a lot of issues. My family's at me. But, you know, this nice team like wants to hear about all my problems. And they're going to talk to me about how I'm feeling the morning of surgery, the day before surgery, the day after surgery. And, you know, I actually personally attended every single one of these surgeries. And I met my patients. I was so happy to have them in our trial that I would go see them on the morning of surgery and thank them for being in the study and just check in with them. And I didn't realize quite what I was doing here, which was...
It says a lot about compassion, doesn't it? And empathy and just being paid attention to, for one. And then it, as you're talking about, it says a lot about placebo. And so we don't have much time left. So I have to ask you about placebo. A lot of people who have had psilocybin or ketamine or LSD or MDMA or, you know, any of these say that they would love to be able to access, create the same sort of experience, but without the drug. And I'm kind of wondering, I mean, that is placebo effect in essence, but I'm also wondering, do you have to have had that experience? I guess not, because those patients.
Well, there is something that they did have. This is kind of what I'm getting at is, you know, a lot of people ask like, so we didn't see a difference between ketamine and placebo in our study. And some people say like, so is ketamine all placebo? And what they should be asking is, where do I get that placebo and how do I recreate it? Because it's not the same as take two and call me in the morning. That's a very mild placebo. What we did, again, inadvertently, is generate a very large placebo effect. And we know something about this. And I want you to think for a second about stories you may have heard in your life. People who've had, for example, survived heart attacks, survived near-death experiences, you know, big events, getting married, having a child, right? These are big, stressful events. And the way that they're framed can, bring about a big change in perspective. Right. People can, you know, the stereotype of the Wall Street banker, hard driving, you know, drinker, smoker, has a heart attack and suddenly they want to talk to their kids again and are vegan. Right. Like big life transformations caused by a big singular event. Surgery is a big singular event. And the framing, we provided a new framing for patients to interpret that experience. So that, you know, when you think about like what is going to drive a large placebo, there's expectations. There has to be some big event to kind of pin those thoughts around. And then there's the framing of what happened.
Yeah. So this makes me think about, there are some parallels here to people who microdose things like psilocybin. And I always ask them, well, like, do you feel this drug inside you? Or is microdosing something that's just a hint of a suggestion that you don't really feel, but somehow it changes you? And, you know, they always say, I don't know.
So that's, you know, these are all, if there's one thing that I want to communicate here, it's that we should not be dismissive of placebo. There is this broad sense that if it's a placebo, you weren't sick to begin with. And that, I think, in many cases, is often dead wrong. That what we're talking about hope, expectancy, integrating life changes, we call that placebo, but really these are, you know, general change mechanisms. And if it happens with microdosing, bravo. You know, that's how do you systematically generate that in our mental health system, right? Hope, expectation, and, you know, integrating change. Those are difficult things to scale up, and our tendency is to prescribe things away. Microdosing is a very interesting example because it brings all these questions together. It's not a perception, like you're not getting an experience of being on a drug, but you are having a different sort of experience, which is engaging in a therapeutic process. You're motivated to change. You're doing something about it. You're taking some agency. And now, you know, you are in it. You're more sensitive sometimes to the things that you feel inside. All of those things are important factors.
And it, yeah, I wanted to take Lynn's question a little bit further, though. So, I mean, if I'm what I'm hearing is, I mean, it's part of the experience. It's the bigger experience. That's what alters you to think differently about how maybe you're living your life, perhaps. So where people are now, you know, this trend of microdosing on, you know, psilocybin and certain drugs like this, is that really affecting the same change, or do you need to have that sit down big trip experience guided by hopefully a doctor or a therapist? Or I mean, you know, which, talk a little bit about that. I mean, sure. Is there, what's there?
So I'll tell you this, it is way, way harder to spot those changes in mental health after microdosing. The studies that have been done are, you know, everyone gets better, but if there doesn't seem to be a difference whether you took the placebo or whether you took the microdose. There are, you know, hints that there may be something there, but it is nothing like the kinds of big effects that you see in these big sit-down psychedelic sessions. That, I think, you can't really get around that, right? So we're talking about different types of, you know, different types of treatment. And, you know, your mileage may vary and, you know, everyone's a little bit different, but some people really need that big, meaningful experience to shake up how they think about life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So fascinating. Boris, we could talk to you all day, but we're just going to have to have you back on The Mountain Life once we find out a little bit more. So Dr. Boris Heifetz is a board-certified anesthesiologist at Stanford Medical School, and he is featured in this fascinating recent article in Scientific American magazine. It is dated July 3rd of 2024, and it's titled, "Is a Drug Even Needed to Induce a Psychedelic Experience?" Dr. Heifetz, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Really interesting.
Thank you, Lynn and Jay. It was a pleasure coming on.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest, Dick Gary, is a familiar face around town. You may know him from his volunteer duties he performs, or maybe he's in your writing group. He has written what he calls a presumptuous memoir of a truly unimportant person, his words, in which he highlights how he has navigated with success and sometimes lack thereof. Dick Gary joins us in the studio to preview his new book. He'll also be at Dolly's for a book signing and possible reading this coming Saturday at 2 p.m. The book is titled Just Another Dick, and we're so happy that Dick Gary could join us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
Well, you have had a lot of careers in your life, and this is one of one of the things that you run through in your book, but tell us about your writing background.
Well, there's not a heck of a lot to tell. Somehow I was always interested in it, and, you know, many, many years ago, when I was in New York, I took a couple of courses at the New School and wound up writing a couple of short stories, but I didn't have time. I was managing a radio station, and I didn't have time for this. The only time I really had when I was recovering from a go-kart or a motorcycle accident.
I love it. So one of the things that strikes me first about your book is this real sense of vulnerability. You are putting it all out there. I mean, most of us have had variable success and some failures in our life, but, you know, we don't really want to talk about the failures, but you are just laying it all out there. Have you always been that way?
What else would I have to say? I think so. I mean, I think that that's the truth. And if you're going to really sit down and write a memoir, there's no sense in doing it if you don't tell the truth. And I don't feel bad about that stuff. I think that I you know, messed up a lot of things, but I think I got lucky. And, you know, as I say, I don't feel bad about it. I just, it was fun going through it again, you know?
Good.
I loved the sense that it was so self-deprecating. We are in this era where so many people are boastful and bragging about all their accomplishments. And it was a refreshing change to see someone coming at it with a humble kind of modest perspective. Tell us a little bit, is that a big part of your life philosophy, or was it a fun way to approach the book? Or
I think maybe it was a true way. And I think that it turns out fun. A lot of the things that are in the book weren't a heck of a lot of fun when they were happening, but they can make a decent story afterwards. So I think that's what it was. And I think humor is maybe my religion, and I love humor, and it just came out that way. And it wasn't a big plan or anything.
I think that's a terrific way to approach things. Tell us, it seemed like you had a very meandering path geographically on your way to Park City. Tell us a little bit about where you've lived on your way to living here.
Well, I was proud to say I was born in Brooklyn, lived on Long Island about 15 miles from the city. When I reached the age of reason, I moved to New York City and worked. And from there, I moved to Los Angeles once again. I was in radio, and I met my fabulous wife in Los Angeles, and we started an advertising agency since I had run a pop station for music labels. So virtually all our clients were in the music business. And I was also a ski fanatic. My first skiing adventure was in Garmisch-Partenkirchen when I was in the army in Germany. And we started the agency, and lo and behold, it became the top agency for music labels in the country. That was a mistake I'm not sorry about. To get with skiing, we came up to Park City once and loved it, and wound up buying a condo here. And then before the Olympics in 2001, we changed it to a house after we started to come up in the summer. And in 2015, we moved here.
Ah.
We also sold our house in Malibu and bought a apartment in Brooklyn. Two very similar places.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with local author Dick Gary. His new book is Just Another Dick, The Presumptuous Memoir of a Truly Unimportant Person. I might also say that this book has very local connections. Katie Mullally, who is my co-host on Cool Science Radio, published this book. And then Stacy Domalski, a longtime Park City person who now lives in California, was your, do we call her a writing coach?
Yeah, and an editor. Stacy and Kathy were both fabulous. Were both fabulous. I mean, Stacy helped me she came up with the idea of how to open the book, which was sensational. And Katie took it from there and, got me on Amazon and all the other things that needed to do. And she's still a good source of information. We're friendly. They're really both great people.
They are, absolutely. Well, you kick it off with chapter one. Well, you have an interesting prologue. I liked your prologue. You kind of say, this is who I am. I'm just a liberal person, and that's kind of how I have gone through my life. And so, I don't know, is that sort of a caveat to someone who maybe that may not appeal to, or maybe it's just to say, this is who I am. Read on.
Well, exactly. This is who I am. If you don't like it, nobody can make everybody happy, but if you want to know the truth, that's who I am. So.
Good.
Yeah. Well, how do you think, when you're telling your stories, do you think that they've been filtered through time? Have they changed in looking back now? Do you think that your wisdom as a mature person has changed the way you look at the events that have happened throughout your life?
Writing the book was fun, reliving all those absurd adventures and misadventures. And they now, while they were, some of them horrendous while they were happening, now they're fun. They're part of the whole scene. And I don't have any regrets. I do feel extremely lucky. And, the advice I'd give someone is, don't be afraid to take a chance. This is your life. Mm. Take a chance. And I think that that, at the underlying probably a lot of it, was the fact that I, not that I'm so brave, but I just was willing to take a chance. When I get bored at something, I stink at it. So I go do something else.
I think that's a great life advice right there. Tell us some, there are some really funny situations in the book. Could you tell us a little, tell us one of the stories that you got a kick out of remembering and writing about?
Oh boy. Well, my military experience was I treated it like a sitcom, and yet I have tremendous respect for the people who are in the service now. I was in a sitcom, they're in a horror show. And I think that just the idea of getting, if you're in the Army, you start to think a certain way, you know? And I remember when we were going to be assigned to something, one of the choices was heavy rocket crewman. And I thought, well, if it's heavy enough, I can ride on it. But when we get it where we're going, I'm going to have to wash it. So I don't want to do that. So, I mean, that's the way you start to think. There was another one that advanced range specialist that I could see myself sitting in the Pentagon in my office. And then I found out that the advanced range specialists were, they were the people who were far, far out in front of the front lines, bringing the artillery into about 8 feet from them. So I bagged that idea and said I'd become a clerk. And they assigned me to an MP, I became an MP, I became a policeman. I thought, I wonder what planning went into that. Very little, I guess. And I wound up as an MP in Germany, and that in itself was a fabulous experience. Back then, you know, people took boats to get over there, and I had a lot of fun.
What was your choice to go into the military, or did you have a choice?
Well, okay. After I got thrown out of college, I spent a summer tending bar in Atlantic City before I was old enough to legally drink. And at one point, my ex-girlfriend, who was my high school sweetheart, came down to see me, and we reestablished our relationship. And one night decided that it was for real and it was for keeps. And she had to get finished with 2 years of college, and I had to either get my military service out of the way, it was mandatory in those days, or finish college. This was August. I didn't think there were too many colleges that were accepting people. So the next morning, I got up and signed up to join the Army. Went over to her house and said, you know, I'm going in 30 days, let's start the fun. So we went to the beach, and I suggested that maybe in 2 weeks we go out to Long Island, the end of Long Island, and have some fun for a weekend. And she said she couldn't because my stand-in, when we were not together, was coming to town, and she had promised him that she would see him. So I basically had a 16-hour engagement. And
that could be included in the, you know, world record book, perhaps.
Well, I was wondering if I could get out of the Army thing, but obviously I couldn't. So that's what led up to the Army.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like to write. Like, what was your writing process? Did you write every day? Is it something that you do in kind of spurts?
Yeah, well, initially it was in spurts. And there were times when Elsa, my wife, and I, we started a nonprofit here in Park City to get young people to register to vote. And I think there were a couple of years when I never sat down to write. But when I did, it was, someone said, is there a lot of pressure? I said, no, there wasn't a lot of pressure. There just wasn't a lot of time. We were, you know, busy that we had, when we had our business in Los Angeles, that took a little time, you know.
Yeah, the most interesting stories tend to come from busy people, though, you know, people with full lives, so that's not a surprise.
Yeah. So You know, one of the things that appeals to me about your book is I find it very difficult to laugh at yourself. But when you can laugh at yourself, it is really liberating. And, you know, your chapter one is called Off and Running in the Wrong Direction. And even the titles and all these stories are you sort of laughing at yourself. But I also wonder if in some way that led to your success, because you were able to say, hey, I did this wrong. Let me try this other thing.
That's a good question, and I think it probably did. I have a great enemy called boredom. Mm. And when I got out of the military and I wound up selling vacuum cleaners in 1960 for $275, I mean, that was just a tough, tough sell. And after a while, I wondered if the vacuum cleaner was as good as they told me, you know, and I didn't want to be taking money from people. So I decided then I'd sell cars in the wintertime in a summer resort. And that's a real, that's a real opportunity to get very poor. So I did that and decided I had to go to finish college, but I had to make some money. And I wound up with this New York employment agency. And I read the ad, and it sounded like it was a good way to kill time, maybe like a lifeguard at a women's health club or something, you know. And it turns out that it wasn't that. What it was a chaser, someone who chases people who owe money. And the territory would have been an area that, you know, few white people get out of alive, and not for all the right reasons, you know, because they haven't treated the residents very well for over 100 years. And anyway, the guy says, I got one more job. It's a salesman announcer at an FM station. And I said, well, I'm really not an announcer. And he says, I understand. You're probably too busy to go on the appointment. And I said, that was you. I'll go, you know. And I got a job in radio. And that was, it was so different. I don't know what it was about it. Well, I do know. It was all of a sudden, instead of trying to grunge this money out of people for cars and vacuum cleaners, it was a creative sell. And it was the first time I'd been involved in creativity. And I got to write the commercials. So I fell in love with radio.
Well, we love radio. I've loved radio for a long time. And, you know, a lot of people in this very small community feel a deep connection to KPCW because it's sort of what you started listening to when you first moved here. And can you talk a little bit about your radio experience and why you love radio?
Well, it was an FM station. And I, you know, frankly, when I went to the interview, I didn't really know what FM was. It was 1963, I think, and it was, there were no FMs in cars. All the stations were AM FMs. And FM was a very tough sell, but it was a creative sell. And at this first station, it was, Muzak owned it, and so it was mostly background music, and there were six employees. I was the sales department, and also it was one of those stations with, if you can sell it, we'll air it. And so I did a couple of ski shows, did a couple of music shows, and I really got to know radio, from all parts of it. And then they sold it to another station, and to WPIX, which was is owned by the Daily News, which was New York's largest newspaper, and a very conservative company, which was exactly the opposite of my beliefs. But anyway, there I advanced to sales manager and then general manager, and I think our mutual philosophies were really kind of getting in the way. And I went to my boss one day and I said, I have a terrific idea. And he said, what's that? I said, fire me. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, come on, you don't like me, I don't like you. And you guys have a policy where if you get canned for every 6 months you've been here, you get a week's pay. I said, I can't afford to quit, I'm a paycheck junkie, you got to fire me. So as the youngest general manager of a New York City radio station, I got fired.
Well, I come from the music business, and I thought you had some great remarks about the music industry. I know it's changed a lot since I started. What has changed about the music industry that you've seen from your experiences since you got started?
Well, I mean, when I got started, what most of the work we did for the music industry was promoting new releases. And I went through, you know, a few different the blank, the tape and the CDs and things like that. And what you did was, you know, first week's release sales were very important. And they had record stores then to sell them out of.
Those were fun.
And I think what happened was that, who was it? Was it Steve Jobs? He came out with, Napster came along.
Oh, yes.
And the music was free.
Yeah.
And it was illegal, but it was free. And then I think Apple came along and said, okay, now we'll release singles. People bought the singles. They didn't buy albums anymore. They just bought the hits. And that has streaming has just overtaken the music business. There's virtually no record stores anymore. Last year, vinyl outsold CDs, which doesn't mean that vinyl sold so incredibly many things. It just meant that hardly anybody bought a CD, you know? So that business has, and also what's changed about it is the way labels hire artists. In order to get signed by a label now, you have to have a massive social media contacts, you know? And awareness, and then the record company becomes your partner, and I think it works for people, but you know they're then partnering with you and
by
you're
taking
touring.
All your money.
But yeah, you're right. You're touring, you're publishing, you know, everything. So it's changed dramatically in that way, I think. And I look at the ratings, and for radio stations, I think they're going to go right through the ground. But they haven't, but I think they've certainly lost the younger audience that was the life, you know, it was the life of radio, or of record labels, yeah.
My kids are both really into vinyl. They both have record players, they buy vinyl, they love vintage vinyl, and the good thing that I think about it is, like you're talking about the single cycle, it used to kind of go back and forth from like an album cycle to a single cycle. But I've talked to the kids before, it's like candy versus a meal. You know, you might like a single when it first comes out, it's really ear candy, it just is so exciting and fun to listen to, but it gets kind of old. And once you listen to a whole album, it's those sleeper tracks that end up being like these themes to your life. Like, they're so incredible. And so I'm really delighted that they're starting to embrace the whole album, because I think that there's a lot of fantastic music that's slipping through the cracks because of that exact thing with selling digital singles.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I kind of like lyrics, maybe because I like writing, but I kind of like the lyrics better than the music. And there's a couple of lyrics. There's a song on South Pacific about you've got to be taught to hate and fear, and it's all about racism. Mm-hmm. You know, it was never
so
a big
current.
Hit, but it's all about racism. And there's another one that Kris Kristofferson had that... it wasn't on Pilgrim. I got a couple of lines from one of his songs in my book. But it was about two kids that walk into this diner, and they don't really have any money, and they ask the person, how much for two bars of candy? And she says, well, that's 10 cents. And these truck drivers are over the table, they say, it's more than 10 cents. And she says, what's it to you? And as they're leaving, she looks down at the table and says, wait, you left too much money here. And she says, they say, what's it to you? And, you know, it just, they're really songs that are very, for me, very emotional. Mm-hmm. And And so I agree with what you say, that after you kind of, if you will, get tired of the big hit, of course, because then meanwhile there's more hits coming on.
Yeah. But I have a question, and we just have a couple of minutes left, about boredom, you said, is your enemy. And you also weren't really a rule follower. I mean, you worked as a bartender before you were drinking age, and that's a big no-no, but there you were. I'm wondering, as you've aged, have you become more of a rule follower? And have you become also more sort of at ease with boredom? Or are you still... You still feel like, no, I cannot be bored. I must change all the time if I become bored.
Yeah, that's true. I still don't want to be bored.
Oh, okay.
And I think that, you know, in my earlier, it's interesting, when I went into, when I started our own business, one of the great things was that I didn't have to put up with all the political stuff mm-hmm. that I was so bad at, you know? And you just became yourself. And I found also with my wise mouth that I didn't have to burn every bridge down. You know, I could leave a couple of them standing and maybe make some money.
I love this. Okay, the book is Just Another Dick, the presumptuous memoir of a truly unimportant person. Our guest is Dick Gary, and he'll be at Dolly's Bookstore here on Main Street, just kitty corner from the radio station, on Saturday at 2 p.m. And before that time, you were so kind to bring a couple copies here to KPCW. We'll leave them on Joe's desk right in front. If we have a couple people listening and you want to grab Dick's book, come on by or give a call first. And we'll see if a few copies are there. So thank you for being generous with your book. And
I'm happy to do it. Did you see any of the reviews on the back?
Oh, yeah. The reviews are great. I love those. Those are great.
Well, I wrote them all.
I love it. There's some honesty. So nice to meet you. I've seen your face around forever. And congratulations on your book.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Mary Beth. You're appreciate welcome. It very much.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can hear this full episode wherever you get your podcasts, on the KPCW app, or by visiting the Shows tab at kpcw.org. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.